Security Ledger podcasts reach an audience of thousands of information technology and information security professionals each week. If that's an audience that you'd like to reach, think about becoming a Security Ledger podcast sponsor. To find out more about sponsoring our podcast, point your web browser to securityledger.com/sales. This is the Security Ledger Podcast, and I'm Paul Roberts, Editor-in-Chief at the Security Ledger. We're back from a week's hiatus. The Security Ledger spent last week attending both the FTC Nix the Fix workshop in Washington, D.C., and CyberArk's Impact event in Chicago. Stay tuned to the podcast for more on both of those events. But first, when we last spoke with Richard Clark, he was on tour to promote his book, Warnings, Finding Modern Cassandras to Stop Catastrophes. In his latest book, The Fifth Domain, co-written with Robert Konacki, Richard goes deep on that very topic. The title is a reference to military parlance for cyberspace, which has joined land, sea, air, and space as a theater for combat. But in this conversation, we talk about how cyberspace is different from all those other domains and how those important differences warrant new thinking about how to secure and protect it. To start off, Richard and I talk about his last book with Mr. Konacki, Cyber War, which a decade ago predicted many of the trends we now see, including destructive cyber attacks launched by militaries. Those were claims that at the time were considered fiction, Richard points out.
Richard Clark, I'm the CEO of Good Harbor Consulting.
Richard, welcome back to the Security Ledger Podcast.
Good to be with you.
So, Richard, last time we had you on the podcast, we were talking about your book, Warnings, and the lessons of modern-day Cassandras. Now the book is The Fifth Domain. Thanks so much for coming in and agreeing to talk to us about it.
Well, thank you for having me. We wrote a book together, Rob and I, 10 years ago, called Cyber War. At the time, we were criticized by some people for being hyperbolic or somebody said file under fiction, because 10 years ago, we predicted that in the future, militaries would be doing a lot of attacks in cyberspace, and critical infrastructure like electric power grids would be targeted, and things would not just be stolen, but things would be destroyed. And so, you know, 10 years later, we look back on those predictions and we say, na-na-na-na-na-na, we were right.
So mature.
It's very mature.
Well, if you turn the clock back 10 years, I can't remember what the context were when you're writing. I mean, we know that the Stuxnet operation was in force at that point. But I think 10 years ago, we probably didn't know about Stuxnet per se.
I don't think the public knew about it at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. But you knew about it?
I couldn't confirm that.
Come on. Water under the bridge. So it's called The Fifth Domain. Why that title? And explain for folks who are listening, what is The Fifth Domain?
Well, the Pentagon and the military talk about land, sea, air, and space as being domains. And now they've added in their vocabulary a fifth domain. That's their Pentagon term. The fifth domain is cyberspace. Now, the difference is land, sea, air, and outer space are natural phenomena. And the fifth domain, cyberspace, is something that we humans created. One thing we talk a lot about in the book is cyber war, the actual idea of militaries fighting each other. If you go to the Department of Justice website now, you can see wanted posters for people who have been indicted for hacking. And you can see their names and their pictures. And they are military officers in the Russian army, the Chinese army, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, the North Korean army. We know who these guys are. And we even have their pictures. You can puzzle about how we get their pictures, but we've got their names, we've got their pictures. This has become a problem of military organizations. The big attacks now, like the NotPetya attack, which caused $10 billion worth of damage around the world, was done by the Russian military. And recently, you know, we've had shots fired, in effect, in cyberspace. The United States has admitted that we had attacked the Russian power grid. We say that we attacked their troll farm in St. Petersburg.
Internet Research Agency,
Right. Which is actually a front for the GRU. And then 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, we leaked that we attacked the Iranian military with a cyber attack rather than using bombs after they shot down the drone. So I would say that the temperature in cyberspace among military organizations is increasing. And when we're saying the Russians are in the control of the U.S. power grid, and then the White House leaks that, well, we got into theirs too. We're in their power grid.
Yeah.
There is a sort of crisis instability situation developing here that needs addressing through international norms, multilateral discussions, confidence building measures, risk reduction measures. None of that's going on.
Akin to what happened during the early days of the nuclear era.
Right. And I was involved in those talks. And, you know, it took a long time. It was difficult. When we began them, we didn't know how we were going to do it, didn't know how we'd solve the verification problem. There were all sorts of difficulties. But we tried, and over years, we got there. We need to do that now. We need to begin that now on cyberspace. Get a bunch of like-minded nations together, agree on norms, and then set up some incentives and disincentives for the nations that are cyber outlaws.
I think the wishful way of thinking about this is, well, maybe it's sort of a mutually assured destruction scenario. And so nobody's going to actually pull the trigger because they're so worried about what might happen, you know, in retaliation.
No one's intentionally going to cause a massive cyber war, but the risk of accidental or escalatory cycles is high now.
If the internet is this thing that is physical, well, that in some ways is physical and in many ways is virtual, but that is most people perceive to be just kind of in the ether, how does that change the thinking about how to protect it?
Well, I think the good news, in a way, as well as the bad news, the flip side of the coin, is that land, sea, air, and outer space, you know, we can't do anything much to change them. But since we created cyberspace, we can affect it. And I think people realize now that how it's important. They realize when it doesn't work, their lives are inconvenienced. I think people now accept cyber war as a real thing. So much has happened since we wrote the book 10 years ago. So I don't think it's a problem of convincing people anymore that they rely on cyberspace or that hostile malicious activities go on in cyberspace. I think people accept that. But while I say we were right, you know, 10 years ago, we were also wrong, because Rob Kanaki and I said 10 years ago, no company can defend itself against a state actor, a sophisticated state actor. Well, that's no longer true. One of the things we discovered in our review of the 10 years, because this book is really about what's gone on in the last 10 years, but more importantly, what's going to go on in the next five. And one of the things we discovered that's different is that there are corporations today in the United States that spend a lot of money that are relatively secure. Maybe somebody can get into their perimeter if they have it, but they can't do much damage. These companies are resilient. They are the dogs that didn't bark. You know, we all know about Target and Equifax and all the Yahoo, all the list of horribles, Marriott. But we don't know the list of the companies that haven't been hacked. And it's an impressive list. They don't like us to talk about them by name, but we interviewed a lot of them and we asked them, you know, basically, why are you so good? Why are you so special?
And what did you find out when you talked to them? Were there commonalities?
Yeah, there were two, and they're linked. The first is governance. The person in charge of the security of the network, typically the chief information security officer or CISO. In the good companies that don't get hacked, the CISO is not buried in the organization chart. The CISO is known by the CEO. In some cases, known by the chairman of the board. There is someone on the board who speaks cyber, and the board is briefed on a regular basis and has metrics and understands what they're being briefed on. That governance structure typically yields adequate resources, and that's the second factor, adequate resources. We find that companies that are pretty secure are spending upwards of 8 or 10%, in some cases more, of their IT budget on security. Now, I know that's a crude measure, but basically what it comes down to is in 1997, when I started doing this, no matter how much money you wanted to spend, you couldn't buy much in the way of security. You could buy a firewall, an antivirus system, and eventually an intrusion detection system. Now, the companies that we interviewed for the book have 50, 60, 70 different discrete cybersecurity apps and products running on their network, each dealing with a different aspect of the malicious threats. So you can spend money. And if you do, and you spend it also on getting a good CISO to integrate all of this and orchestrate all of it, you can be secure. That's different than maybe 5 years ago. Because one of the things you can buy, you know, is endpoint detection and response system, a so-called EDR. That helps a lot. You can put things in the cloud. When you put all of these things together, they're more than the sum of their parts there. But it takes a lot of money to buy all of these things. It takes a lot of money to hire the people to put them all together and continuously monitor them and also see, oh, there's a new threat. Is there a new product that deals with that new threat? So it's a never-ending struggle. You can't go out and spend 8 or 10% for a couple of years and say, oh, good, we're done. That's an ongoing expenditure.
Folks like Wendy Nather talked about the security poverty line, right? This notion that, you know, security becomes something for rich companies that poor companies can't afford. Is that in some ways what you're talking about, which is, you know, yeah, you can be secure if you can afford it. Some companies may not be able to afford it.
Well, you can outsource security too. You know, there are managed security services, managed security service providers, MSSPs. They're not that expensive, and they'll take a lot of the burden off of you, both in terms of the personnel that you can't find and in the low-level problems that a lot of your security personnel would have to deal with otherwise. And if you use the cloud, you're also getting some security benefit from Amazon or Microsoft or whoever's cloud you use. Yeah, you do have to spend a lot of money, but I don't think it's going to bankrupt anybody. I don't think it's a bridge too far for most corporations. Now, what we've seen lately is municipal governments, places like Atlanta and Baltimore and whatnot, they're obviously stretched for money and they have other things to spend it on, like education and police and fire. But if they don't spend it on cybersecurity or they don't outsource, they end up with networks that are hit by ransomware and their entire network stop and the city government stops.
In addition to talking about what some private companies are doing right, you have some pretty harsh assessment of particularly the federal government and its kind of inability to get its arms around the cybersecurity problem over the last two decades. If we were to look at the root of the problems that the federal government, let's say, has had wrestling with cybersecurity and nation state actors and so on, what is the root of those problems?
There are a couple, but the one that we focus on most in the book is the whole notion that an Office of Personnel Management, which is like the HR for the federal government, the whole notion that they should be running their own computer network and they should be trying to secure their own computer network against the People's Liberation Army of China is ludicrous. There are so many federal agencies they're incapable of running and shouldn't be asked to run their own network and defend their own network. So what we propose in the book is that they should do what some of the state governments like New York and Virginia have done, which is to take that burden off the agencies and departments and create an IT services department and have that provide IT as a service to the other federal agencies. Now, obviously, the Pentagon's going to run its own, but most of the little federal agencies can't do it, and some of the big ones can't do it. So they should be able to get it as a service from a federal IT department, including cybersecurity. We propose the creation of something called the Senior Cyber Service. We already have the Senior Executive Service, the Senior Foreign Service, the Senior Intelligence Service. We'd like to create the Senior Cyber Service, put it in the new cybersecurity agency over at Homeland Security, and have them be the CISOs throughout the government, have them be running security throughout the government. This is not something that we can ask the Department of Labor or the Department of Agriculture or the Parks Department, you know, to do. It's not realistic.
Of course, that does mean you're going to have to say Senior Cyber Service over and over again, Richard.
Yeah, and that could be a problem. There's a proposal in the book that we have a cyber insurance backup. Yeah, well, the government provides a terrorism insurance backup. Mm-hmm. The terrorism backup insurance is designed for if there's another big terrorist attack like 9/11 that would bankrupt the insurance industry, the government steps in. And the reason the insurance companies are not willing to write big cyber policies right now, they'll write cyber policies, but not for a lot of money, is because they're all afraid of a cyber 9/11 where every one of their clients gets hit at the same time and mm-hmm. and they get bankrupt paying it out. So we propose a cyber insurance backup program modeled after the terrorism one. Mm-hmm. But our acronym for it comes out being Syria. yeah, you see, you have the same reaction that Rob and I had to our own proposal.
Rethink that one, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you also proposed this IT services agency, ITSA, a much more manageable acronym. Talk a little bit about that, because that's actually pretty critical to your proposal as to how to do a makeover, a security makeover for the federal government.
Well, we take the model of the states like New York and Virginia, and we say there's an IT department. And it's a services department. It provides services. And one by one, agencies, federal agencies, other than the Defense Department, the intelligence community, one by one, the civilian agencies, contracts that they have now for IT, when they roll off those contracts, they roll into support from this new agency. The new agency would obviously have to outsource, just as every federal agency does. But you have to have a key group of experts to oversee the government contractors who provide you support. And you have multiple government contractors providing you support so you can switch from one to the other if one screws up. That's something that would take many years. It would save a lot of money in the end because you wouldn't be replicating over and over and over again. You'd create a series of federal clouds, not just one. You'd have services, federal cloud services, probably from Amazon and Microsoft and maybe IBM and Rackspace, who knows. It would take away the burden. The poor woman who was running OPM at the time of the hack when the Chinese stole my information and everybody else's, she was a wonderful person. She had done great things. She was doing a great job at the HR policies, but she got fired after that. And I, you know, on the one hand, I thought she deserved it. On the other hand, I felt sorry for her. She wasn't an IT expert. But the problem was she hadn't tried to get IT experts to come in and realize that there were some crown jewels out there in OPM. And, we can't ask people who are experts in health or human services or veterans affairs or whatever it is. We hold those secretaries responsible. Yeah. But we can't really expect them to know very much about IT security because their expertise is in another area. So let's take that burden off them, create an IT services department, which is pronounced ITSA. That's not bad. And maybe over the course of several years, we can improve federal cybersecurity because it doesn't improve. Year over year, the scores of these various departments, they don't improve significantly. And there's no penalty for the most part until there's a big hack and then they fire the director. But, you know, year after year, if the Interior Department gets a C or a C-minus rating in its FISMA score, Federal Information Security Management Act score, there's really no punishment.
I know in the private sector, and because I talk to a lot of companies, obviously in the information security space, risk-based approaches to security is pretty much accepted wisdom now. It's what everybody's talking about, you know, that you need to reorient your security program based on risk. And OPM is a great example of that, because if you took a risk-based approach to security, all of a sudden OPM would kind of pop out at you from the map and say, oh, right. Man, like right. This is where, as you said, all the crown jewels are. And it's this kind of low-profile agency, but it's holding on to tremendously valuable information. This is probably a stupid question, but is there any evidence that that's actually happening now at the federal level, either in the wake of OPM or just by virtue of evolution, that there is more risk-based thinking in terms of securing federal IT?
No, you know, there, for those who don't understand how the federal government works at this level of detail, there's a compliance focus as opposed to a risk focus, and they're very different things. Compliance is a checklist of sort of good hygiene. And you can have good hygiene. You can have all checks on your checklist and still have very poor security. I know that sounds contradictory, but it's not. And it's not just in the government, really. You know, there are a lot of companies that are regulated by the government. And the regulators have a compliance approach as well. And I've talked to a lot of companies in the private sector that say, you know, half or more of my IT security staff aren't doing IT security. They're doing compliance.
Filling out questionnaires and spreadsheets and stuff like that. Yeah.
And even things for a vendor supply chain, you know, companies now want to know that the other companies that they work with are secure. So they create these checklists for supply list security. And now you have to do compliance for your customers. So there's compliance for government regulation. There's compliance for other customers. Sometimes you're doing the same compliance checklist over and over again, rather than sharing assessments in some systematic way. We need to automate compliance, which I think is doable. And have that done on a continuing basis,
Stop having people do it.
Stop having people do it. Have it done with continuous monitoring apps. It's doable with today's technology. And let's get our IT security people back doing security.
A couple questions on the Internet of Things. So you have a whole chapter on 5G and the Internet of Things. When we think about security for both these things, 5G and the Internet of Things, which are intertwined in many ways, are we in a situation where the horse has left the barn, or is there still time to kind of get Internet of Things security right in a way that maybe we didn't get Internet security right?
Well, some of the horses are out of the barn. They're two separate things again, but related. There's 5G and there's IoT. On the 5G side, the fundamental problem here is that the Federal Communications Commission, which I think, reading the law, I'm not a lawyer, but reading the law, could very well issue security guidelines for the 5G technology, really hasn't done that in a serious way. And it's ideological. Because there are a bunch of people, let's admit it, is say it, they're Republicans. The Republicans in the Congress and the Republicans on the FCC have repeatedly not wanted to regulate anything related to the internet. And they say, oh, we only do telephony. Yeah. And it's not, you know, that's just ridiculous. 5G should be regulated seriously for cybersecurity. The civil servants in the FCC, the experts, listed a whole series of questions to the 5G industry about security. But so they're aware of the risks, but they didn't do regulation in serious regulation to control security aspects of 5G. That's a problem. Internet of Things is already here, even without 5G. It's going to be empowered even more by 5G. And the problem with the Internet of Things is that most of the devices on the Internet of Things, whether it's your nanny cam in your house or the heart-lung machine in the hospital, they were never designed with security in mind. And the chipset, the actual hardware firmware, in many cases, is so small you can't insert the kind of security things you'd want to have. You can't have an authentication, identity access management.
Sure.
You can't have an EDR endpoint system. They're just too small. So people are beginning to wake up to this and beginning to realize that we have to architect the Internet of Things around the legacy devices. The FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, was for a long time the problem with medical devices because they said, oh, we certified these devices. You can't change anything. Well, that meant if you had Windows 98 running, you couldn't even do a Windows 98 update, let alone get a new Windows program. So there were literally medical devices throughout the country running unpatched Windows 98. FDA has now changed its attitude 180 degrees and is saying, that's okay to change things. You know, you have to, in fact, have updated software on your devices. But it's going to take a long time to deal with the legacy devices that typically are out there for 10 or 20 years. In some cases, even longer.
So we were talking about sort of the federal government's response to cyber security threats and, you know, how they've kind of been slow on the uptake. And I've always had this working theory that one of the problems was that 9/11 happened and we kind of took our eye off the cyber ball and spent a bunch of years worrying about people flying planes into buildings. But it strikes me that you were sort of there and in the halls of power when 9/11 happened, obviously, and before that. And I want to ask you, is that accurate? I mean, is that one explanation for why we were slow to respond to what the Chinese were doing, let's say, or why it took so long to get a sense of urgency around cybersecurity, you know, within key federal agencies?
That's an interesting question. You know, the what ifs of history. What if, you know, this hadn't happened or that hadn't happened? If 9/11 had not happened, if Al-Qaeda hadn't been a major problem, would I have been able to get more focus in the federal government on cybersecurity? Yeah, I think so. You got to remember that before 9/11, in the Clinton administration, Clinton had created an entire program in PDD 63 for cybersecurity, the first ever. He had created the first national plan for cybersecurity, which if you go back and read it, it's not bad. In fact, the Trump national strategy looks a lot like it 20 years later. And the money was beginning to open up in the federal government. We began then to organize the private sector to deal with cybersecurity by creating the information sharing and assessment centers in various industry verticals. And after 9/11, Bush issued the national strategy for cybersecurity. Mm-hmm. I wrote it. I think it was a pretty good plan. But I think you're right that he didn't focus on it in terms of implementing it. You know, he thanked me for it. Great plan. But when I left, there was not a lot of implementation that followed for, you know, 4 or 5 years, actually.
Yeah. Well, and the Iraq War happened and a whole lot of other stuff, a lot of kinetic stuff was going on in the background, but yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, one final question. So you talk a fair amount also about preparing for the worst and focusing on resilience. What does that mean? For example, I know the federal government has done some exercises around like manually restarting the grid in the event of a cyber attack on the grid on a small scale. Should we be looking really hard at having analog backups for, you know, key functions and being able to operate in the absence of the internet and so on?
I think we need sector by sector to think about how we would make things work to some minimal level if we had a prolonged period without electricity or a prolonged period without internet connectivity. You can't have analog backups for everything, but you do need to think about, for example, you mentioned restarting the grid. It's not just a matter that the cyber attack would shut off the grid. It's that the cyber attack would destroy generators, physically destroy them, physically destroy transformers. We don't have a bunch of them laying around. We don't have a lot of spares. Maybe we should get some spares. Maybe we should have a more diverse source of power, more localized sources of power, using alternative energy sources, more segmented networks. Yes, we do need to think about what minimal things we can do in case of massive failures.
Richard Clark, thanks so much for coming on and talking to us again on Security Ledger Podcast.
Thank you, and I hope you enjoy the book.
Richard Clark is the CEO at Good Harbor Consulting. He's a former National Coordinator for Security, Infrastructure Protection, and Counterterrorism for the United States, and a veteran of four administrations, from President Ronald Reagan through President George W. Bush. His new book, The Fifth Domain, Defending Our Country, Our Companies, and Ourselves in the Age of Cyber Threats, is now out on Penguin Press.